Well, Representative Torkelson, we do not have a quorum yet, but when that happens, I'll quickly gavel us back to order. If you want to address your bill, and then I will officially start the meeting once we have quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2634 is a bill that relates to SSTS, subsurface sewage treatment systems. It's a permissive bill that allows our counties more flexibility in dealing with the standards on SSTS. It's supported broadly by the Association of Minnesota Counties and by Minnesota PCA. They've worked hard on this in the interim, come to the compromise that will help our counties effectively regulate SSTS in the state of Minnesota. I do have testifiers, but I don't really think they're necessary unless you'd like to hear some more information, Madam Chair.
Does anyone have any questions for Representative Torkelson? Well, if you want to have someone come up and address us for a minute, that'd be fine, as long as we're waiting for quorum anyway.
The testifier is approaching the table.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I want to thank Representative Torkelson for carrying this bill. Last year, we were before the legislature, and we asked for an extension to allow counties some more time to adopt rules in the state, to adopt these septic system rules, and also to allow us some more time to work out some areas where we could find some more flexibility with the rule adoption with the Pollution Control Agency. And this piece that's before you is one of the pieces that we've negotiated with the Pollution Control Agency. The other areas that we've identified for flexibility do not need to be statutorily made. AMC is really pleased with the negotiation that we came out to give counties some more flexibility. Essentially what this does is it will allow counties to adopt alternative local standards, which will give us some more flexibility when we go to adopt our septic system ordinances in terms of what counties need and what's appropriate for residents, where we can get some more of that flexibility in our ordinances.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, we do have another bill coming up that's going to take the majority of our time, so I think we'll just wait here for a minute until we get a quorum. We just need one more member. We'll try to track some down.
Mr. Kudelka from the PCA is here, Madam Chair. If you would like to hear the PCA's perspective on the bill.
Okay, that'd be great. Welcome to the committee.
Chair and committee members, my name for the record is Kirk Kudelka. I'm the legislative director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And as Ms. Garlitz had mentioned, this is an agreement between Association of Minnesota Counties, the County Planning and Zoning Administrators, along with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, to move forward on the 2008 SSTS rules. And it does allow for us to use the good cause rulemaking exemption to go in real quick, make a very small change to make statute match rules, and to go out, which will save us time and expenses.
Okay. Was there any member of the public that wished to testify? We do have a quorum now, so I will officially call the Government Operations and Elections Committee to order. And Representative O'Driscoll, would you like to approve the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes from the Wednesday, March 21st meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Committee.
Representative O'Driscoll moves approval of the minutes from Wednesday, March 21st. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I'd also like to move House File 2634 to recommend passage and move to the Representative Torkelson General Register.
Yes.
To the General Register, please.
So moved. Are there any other additional questions for Representative Torkelson before we move to a vote? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. We'll move on next to House File 2199, the Omnibus Pension Bill. Representative Lanning, I will move that House File 2199 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. And I see you've... There's an amendment in the packet. Is that your amendment, Representative Lanning?
No.
Okay. Do you want to...
I'm sorry. Is that the delete everything amendment?
Yes.
Yes.
The 55A?
54A.
54A is to delete everything. 55A is the technical review.
Madam Chair,
54A is the delete everything amendment, and 55A is a technical amendment.
Okay. I will move the 54A amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail. And then I will also move amendment 55A. And it's technical, so I trust you'll explain this to us when it's in the shape that you'd like.
Okay.
All in favor of the 55A amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion does prevail, and now the bill is in the shape you'd like. And
thank you, Madam Chair and members. And the motion I noted was to have it go to State Government Finance. That's not necessary. The bill would go to Ways and Means, would be the next stop.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's not the information I had. I will amend my motion that House File 2199 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Madam Chair?
Representative Winkler.
For the amendment of your motion, I wonder if the author could remind us of past times when the pension bill has not gone through the State Government Finance Committee.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, given my short history, I would defer to Mr. Martin to answer that question.
Mr. Martin, and before you answer the question, if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
I'm Lawrence Martin. I'm the director of the Pension Commission staff. It's not always the case that the omnibus pension bill goes to one of the finance divisions or the finance committees or Ways and Means. In recent years, it has been going to Ways and Means almost every year. Sometimes it has gone to the State Government Finance Committee, but not always. Last year, for instance, it did not.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I just find it curious that the bill would have to go to Ways and Means for financial reasons, but skip the Finance Committee that deals with these pensions. And, you know, obviously I don't have the votes to change that, but it doesn't seem like a very good practice.
Back to your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I'm going on past practice, and as chair of the State Government Finance Committee, I do not see the need for this bill to go before that committee. First of all, I'd like to give you a little bit of background with regard to the omnibus pension bill. Our joint House and Senate Pensions Commission, which consists of five members of the House, five members of the Senate, didn't really get formally organized until May of this past year, 2011. And so obviously we had a very short time frame in which to consider pension legislation. Nonetheless, we were able to, in last year's bill, accomplish something that had been in the works and controversial for many years, and that had to do with the getting the Minneapolis Police and Fire both merged with PERA. That had been a very difficult issue for all concerned for many years, and we were able to get that resolved last year and did get the omnibus bill approved. It had a number of other important provisions in it, but that was the most significant issue that we resolved. Since we didn't have much time last spring, as chair, I felt that we needed some significant time during the interim in which the commission could be looking at a number of pension-related issues, and to do so taking the appropriate amount of time and consideration that was needed. Therefore, we had 6 days of meetings. We had 3 two-day meetings that we scheduled last fall, where we looked at a whole host of issues. We reviewed what's been happening with respect to the 2010 reform that was enacted. That reform, in our view, as a commission, has been producing dividends to our whole system. It was a positive reform. I fully supported that reform, even though I was not on the commission at the time. Representative Murphy did a fabulous job of putting that together and getting it through the House in 2010. that reform, as I said, has produced some very significant results for us to this point, and we affirm that as a commission. We talked about what additional kinds of reform or issues we need to address in this session, 2012. And there were a couple of areas in particular we spent a lot of time as a commission examining. The first was the whole issue of the assumed rate of return on our pension funds. Since 1989, Minnesota has followed an assumed rate of return of 8.5% on our investments. That was set in 1989. It has not been fully reviewed and reconsidered until now, just recently with the work that we started last fall. Minnesota's 8.5% is the highest in the country, the highest assumed rate in the country. And, of course, during the 90s, that assumed rate of return looked like it was pretty good prediction or projection. But in the last 10 years, things have changed dramatically. In the last 10 years, we haven't even come close to earning 8.5% on our investments. The percentage has been 5.9%. And when you consider one of the years, the most recent year was 23%, that would actually lower that 5.9 by a significant amount as well. And there was a growing concern among us as commission members and on part of many about the need for Minnesota to take a closer look at that rate of return and see if a different approach maybe should be followed. The other thing that we spent a lot of time on was looking at the study of the defined benefit system and whether or not we ought to be looking towards any defined contribution alternatives. And the results of our examination basically reaffirms the defined benefit program that we've followed for many years. We believe that that is the right thing for Minnesota to continue to do. And we took a look at maybe adding some options to that would pursue some kind of limited defined contribution elements, which would give employees more freedom, more flexibility, more portability with regard to their funds, more ability to help determine where those funds get invested. We spent a lot of time looking at different options. We looked at what was called hybrid options. And at the end of the day, we did not find a proposal that we as a commission felt was ready for prime time. And so the bill that you have before you does not have any proposed change with regard to defined benefit and the issue of defined contributions. Well, then when the session started back in January, we as a commission have been meeting weekly. We have, every time we've met, we've heard from the funds as to what their concerns were, the issues were. We've heard from a whole host of folks who are concerned about the whole pension issue. And as a result of all those considerations, we put together this House File 2199. What this bill contains, and I'll highlight a few things and then turn it over to Mr. Martin to highlight some more of the details or fine points with regard to it. The first thing that relates back to this issue of an assumed rate of return, we believe, and we in our bill are proposing that for the next 5 years we set the assumed rate of return at 8%. And 8% right now is the level at which probably the greatest number of other states or funds are following that. There are funds that have less than that, go all the way down to 7% or 7.5%. But as I mentioned, at 8.5%, There are only 9 funds state nationally, and 4 of those are Minnesota funds. And we believe that we ought to go down to 8%. Then we believe also that the next 5 years, that all the funds ought to undergo experience studies to help give the legislature and all those concerned about pensions a good analysis and information about the appropriateness of assumed rate of return and the other kinds of assumptions that are in our system at this point in time. And then the bill now provides what's called a select and ultimate, where after 5 years, we would automatically go back up to 8.5%. But I want to point out that given the results of those experience studies, the legislature could decide that, no, we ought to leave it at 8, or we ought to lower it, whatever. But the bill right now calls for it to go back up to 8.5%, obviously subject to whatever future legislative action that there might be with respect to this issue. Another significant bit of reform that's in this bill is to is to change the opportunity for better transparency. And we, in the bill, call for management and budget to report on budgeted and forecasted defined benefit contributions to give everybody a better information, legislators better information, as to what is the real status of our defined benefit funds. And so that people can track that and have better information with regard to it. Another significant bit of change is related to the merger of the Fairmont Police Relief Association and Virginia Fire into PERA. We took care of 2 of those last year, and these 2 are the last 2 of those independent funds to be now merged into PERA. Members, at one time years ago, we had 44 of these independent funds out there that were really on their own, and that was not the kind of good strategy we felt with respect to managing our funds statewide. And so this bill finishes that job that was started years ago by merging the last 2 of those independent funds into PERA. I want to also say that this bill, with the change in the assumed rate of return, does not force, and I emphasize this, does not force any change in benefits. There are no change in benefits that are required with this or ordered with this. No change in contributions, either by employees or employers. We are not forcing any of those kinds of actions to be taken. But it needs to be understood, obviously, that with the assumed rate of return dropping down for the next 5 years to 8%, that will result in a slight increase in unfunded liabilities. We've got a problem even now with unfunded liabilities, and so it would slightly alter that. Depending on what happens going forward in the next 5 years, the legislature may be forced, the funds may be forced to look at changes in benefits or contributions. But I emphasize, this bill does not force or require any of those kinds of changes. Well, that is kind of my overview of the significant things in this bill. There are a whole host of other technical and significant, but not as in the same category of significance of other items in this bill. And I would like to call on Director Martin to highlight some of those. And I would just point out, too, that this bill, there are 9 different House members that have bills that are incorporated into this omnibus bill.
Hey, Director Martin. Welcome to
the members. Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm Larry Martin from the Pension Commission staff. You've dealt now with two different amendments, the bulk amendment. The largest amendment is 54A document, and I'm going to be spending my time brief discussion of what's in that. The chair asked that I also cover what's in 55A, the technical amendment, to verify that it is technical. These are three errors or problems that the revisor's office, when they reviewed the 54A amendment, identified. One was a bad site citation. That's the first change. The second was a provision that both provided for an expiration and a repeal of a provision. They pointed out that either one or the other would be fine, and so we've done away with our repeal language. And then there was a bad effective date from a provision from a bill that was carried over from the 2011 session and had a 2011 effective date when it really should have been a 2012 effective date. So those are the three technical amendments in the 55A amendment. Representative Lanning has talked a bit about Articles 1 and 2 and Article 11 of the 54A document, the Omnibus Pension Bill for 2012. Article 1 is the interest rate assumption change and is the primary change there, and he's covered the nature of the Commission's conversations about the interest rate assumption and where Minnesota stands and what this would do. Article 2, he also talked about the transparency. This is an aggregation of a lot of existing information that will be put into one place by management and budget on the basic financial and actuarial information related to our Minnesota public pension plans. The idea is to provide a one stop for finding basic pension information for Minnesota. The base bill that you have, House File 2199, relates to the MSRS correctional plan and is the item covered in Article 3 of the 54A amendment. This is a somewhat routine bill that clarifies or revises the membership of the MSRS correctional plan, primarily to address changes in occupational titles within the two state agencies that have employees covered by this plan, the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services. In this case, it's the Department of Human Services at the St. Peter Hospital and at the Sex Offender Pro Program. An amendment that was added to the bill during the course of the Commission's deliberations has to do with the former Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program up at Cambridge. That program is being drastically altered by virtue of a settlement of federal litigation, and that will affect the employees and up there, both as to the number and the function that they will have in the future with the DHS. The bill provides for a one-year holding period for the current members of the former MITO program will stay in the correctional plan pending the resolution of the ultimate nature of that program, which should occur between now and the end of the 2013 session. Article 4 has to do with the MSRS Healthcare Savings Plan and is mostly administrative modifications proposed by the plan. Article 5 has to do with the MSRS Unclassified Plan. It clarifies the change that was made in 2010 with respect to which existing members of that program have the opportunity and when they have the opportunity to change to the MSRS General Plan rather than the Defined Contribution MSRS Unclassified Program. Article 6 has to do with PERA. Probably the primary thing I would point out here, Representative O'Driscoll had a bill which would have changed the threshold salary for PERA membership. PERA is the one plan that we have in the state where a certain level of minimum salary is required before someone becomes a member of PERA. That salary figure has been set for some considerable period of time. The O'Driscoll bill would have changed it. the change was viewed as problematic by the employing groups that would have been affected, and so it was replaced by a study from PERA to look at various options to modify or update that minimum salary threshold. And that's one of the principal items in Article 6. Article 7 has to do with the PERA privatization law. There are a number of health care facilities that are government-owned and have been privatized in recent years. There is a process for taking some of the actuarial gain that accrued to PERA by virtue of an employing unit prematurely terminating all of its employees from PERA coverage by virtue of privatizing, and using some of that gain or all of that gain to provide a somewhat in enhanced benefit for the individuals who are losing their pension coverage that they otherwise would have had but for the privatization. This article modifies the principal benefit that's provided by the privatization law, which is an enhanced deferred annuities augmentation rate, making it more consistent with the augmentation rates that were provided for in the 2010 piece of legislation. Article 8 has to do with TRA and our administrative changes, and principally here is taking some of the state aid and other outside governmental entity aids that were previously paid to the Minneapolis teachers and incorporating them better into the TRA statutes and providing for a mechanism to make sure that there are timely payments of those aid amounts. Article 9 is a conformity article. The Federal Internal Revenue Code increasingly regulates aspects of public employee pensions, and there are a number of conformity provisions that are needed to continue tax qualification by the federal government for our public employee pension plans, and this article makes those changes. Article 10 has to do with the investment authority for both the State Board of Investment with respect to its investment of the various statewide public pension plan assets and also the various local plans, primarily volunteer fire plan investments. This represents the work of a special working group that was assembled pursuant to a legislative directive by the State Auditor's Office to look at the investment authorization statutes and to better coordinate them, and this article does that in providing for more comparability between what the investment authority of the State Board of Investment and for the local plans might be. Article 11 is the consolidation that Representative Lanning talked about of Fairmont Police and Virginia Fire. These are the last two freestanding local police or paid fire pension plans in the state, and these are being merged into PERA this spring. Article 12 is the various changes related to volunteer fire programs. This covers both the relatively new statewide lump sum volunteer fire pension plan that's administered by PERA, and in this case the change is to permit municipalities to make some advance funding or additional contributions to the plan and when they have extra fire state aid or have other revenue that they want to dedicate for volunteer fire pension purposes. The balance of the article relates to local volunteer fire plans. We have in the neighborhood of 700 or more local volunteer fire pension plans in the state of Minnesota. Principally, these are changes that come from the working group that has been assembled for the past several years by the Office of the State Auditor, and clarifies various aspects of the current volunteer fire laws. Then the last article, Article 13, is the small group or one-person pension provisions. These are modifications or special authorizations for individuals or small groups that were heard by the Pension Commission, something akin to almost a claims commission process for the commission trying to decide when there should be some a relief granted from otherwise generally applicable rules. Covered here are four different changes, one relating to the Seaway Port Authority of Duluth, the other a Minsky employee who wasn't given proper advice upon being hired in Minsky, a Crookston Township snowplow operator who missed 17 years of service credit in PERA, and the spouse of a deceased Ominomen County deputy sheriff for which a total and permanent disability benefit was not applied for in the proper time period. Mr. Chair, that covers, I think, what's in the 54A amendment, mm-hmm. represents the work of the 2012 Pension Commission with respect to our various pension plans. I'd be happy to answer questions if there are any questions about the bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Martin. Are there any questions from the members for either Mr. Martin or Chair Lanny? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Martin, maybe you aren't the one to ask this question, but which direction are our underfunding of the plans moving? Are we getting better? Are we moving towards being fully funded, or are they? I know that Representative Lanning mentioned that with the change of the assumed interest rate, that it actually has a negative effect on that. But how are we in the last couple of years? How are we moving on for funding of our plans?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, the plans, by virtue of the 2010 piece of legislation and the benefit reductions that were part of that piece of legislation and the contribution increases that were part of that piece of legislation, have had their funding improved. Also, as the start of a somewhat slow recovery from a recession, most recoveries do involve a more substantial investment return, and that's been the case, although not as significant as we might have liked. So the pension plans have had their liabilities decreased by the 2010 piece of legislation and their assets increased by the normal investment process that follows a recession. So their funding ratios are improving. I can't give you the numbers off the top of my head. We do have them. The administrators of the various pension plans here, if you did want to get specific funding numbers, but there's been a general improvement.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. And as I said, it was mentioned, the change in the assumption of the return on the plan, what that effect, my understanding is that has the effect of lower or stretching that time out, of actually increasing that on a that liability, and am I correct in that? Is that how that works?
Mr. Mark.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative. Going to an 8% interest rate assumption would increase recognized liabilities. The change here is going to an 8% interest rate assumption for a period of 5 years and then returning to an 8.5% interest rate assumption. So there will be some increased liabilities by virtue of that five-year period. But given the generalized long nature of pension funding, that's a fairly modest period of time and will not have a dramatic increase in the liabilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Martin, can we assume that this will be a very small change in the underfunding, though, because my understanding is the 8% will be used for 5 years, but the calculation will still assume that it bounces back to 8.5% for the balance of that time. So really we're talking about a very short period here where we're calculating at the 8% level.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have not seen any actuarial work yet on the exact changes in the unfunded by virtue of the five-year only change in the interest rate assumption. But as you pointed out, given the short period that rate is going to be in place under statute as it currently exists or will exist, and compared to the long-term payout of members, the life of the plan, which is 50-60 years, it's a very short period of time, and it would be I would expect it to be a very nominal change.
Okay, thank you, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm just wondering what the percentage of the unfunded liability is, and if you have people here that could tell us. I would like to know how it's been trending, for instance, for the past 5 years, and the expected trend for the next 5 years. Is that available so that we could see that?
Mr. Martin.
There are people here who can specifically address it. It would take a second to find out the paperwork. Maybe we could have MSRS or PERA come up and give you their numbers.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. And please state your name for the tape, and then if we could address Representative Scalzi's question.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. And I'll focus on our big plan, our General Employees Retirement Fund. Our General Employees Retirement Fund in 2007 was 97% funded. By 2009, it had dropped to 69% funded on a market value. And on a market value today, or as of June 30th, we were 87% funded. So what has happened is the law change in 2010 cut our liabilities, and then we've had 2 years of strong market return, and it's made a dramatic improvement.
Mr. Bergstrom, could you address maybe the question that Representative Nelson had then as to what percentage maybe this 8 to 8.5 change would have on the overall underfunding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, going from 8.5 to 8 would lower our funding ratio by about 4%, 4 to 5%. It would increase our required contributions by 2%. The bill, as it stands with the 5-year rate, would lower our funding ratio by 1.5% or 2%, and have increase our required contributions by about 0.5%. So the bill as it stands, the impact is about a quarter, roughly, of going all the way down to the full 8%.
Mr. Chair, first I had Representative Simon had a question.
Mr. Chair, that was a while ago. I was going to recommend that we have this exact parade of testifiers, so to hear from them directly. But actually, now that I have the microphone, I guess I would ask each testifier, if they could, to talk about, if they can, how your particular fund compares with comparable funds in other states. We've heard about certain states being really underwater, and if you could tell us how you're doing comparatively.
Mr. Chair, the Minnesota State Retirement System at 87% would be in the upper tier of funding. I believe the average nationwide is in the 78-79% funded ratio. So we would be above that.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on the question I had about them that he answered about the where we're at and how this is going to affect it. Mr. Bergstrom, if market trends continue as they've been the last couple of years, and the economy growing and getting stronger, do you foresee your fund becoming fully funded, or getting to that point where it's fully funded or above 90% funded in the next couple of years, even with this actuarial change?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, if the markets continue like they were the last 2 years, we could get to 90% funded. If we earn 8.5%, we probably trend we would stay about the same. So this would drop us down a little, but not dramatically. But if we have two more strong years, we had a 23%, I think it was a 23% return last year. I made a huge difference in 15% before that. So a few years of 10 or higher and we'd be fine. But I don't know what that would be. But, I mean, I certainly can't project that, or I'd be making a lot of money somewhere.
Mr. Bergstrom, could you tell us what is a healthy range for assumed rate of interest, assumed assumption here?
What is a healthy rate?
Healthy range. Do we know, I mean, is 8 the right number? Is 8.5 the right number? Is 7? Is there some range out there that...
Mr. Chair, there is no magical number. They're all wrong, as Mr. Bicker would always say, is it's just a guess. The most typical is 8. In most states, by far, the most typical rate is 8%.
Recently, CalPERS, I believe, have been recommended by their actuaries to drop their assumed rate of interest from 7.5 to 7.25. Have you followed that, and can you explain why they're looking at going to a much lower rate of interest than what we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, we have been following that. Their returns have not been as strong. Their asset allocation is different. The other thing they did, and I don't remember the exact, you know, we smooth our gains and losses over 5 years. They changed theirs, I think it was over a 20-year period. So what, you know, CalPERS has done a lot of things not well, and I certainly don't think we want to follow their lead. So what they did essentially is say, oh, we'll recognize those big losses and the recent gains over a 20-year period. So they have a lot of different dynamics going on as well. Clearly, the trend in the business has been to lower it, and Representative Lanning's bill does take that step down, or start that process. But we've been following this closely.
Okay, thank you. Representative Simon. I'm sorry, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, what is considered to be a safe funding ratio or a desired funding ratio? And what target are we aiming at?
Mr. Chair, our goal is to, and President Winkler, is to get to 100% of funding. That's kind of the Pension Commission's trigger. I guess I've always, if to simplify it, and I don't know if my colleagues agree, but if you go in the olden school days, anything over 90% is an A, B is 80%, and C is 70%. And that's after 70% when you fall to that low. Then you start to get nervous. That's why we came back in 2010 after the big drop. You know, it was not a good time. And in fairness, you also have to look at the contribution rates, whether they're sufficient or not. You know, where MSRS is 87% funded, we also have a contribution deficiency currently of 1%. So at some point, we will have to address that. When we put together our package in 2010, we did expect some market recovery, and it has worked. But we will clearly monitor this to make sure that we move. So, but that's just my general rule.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, you already said this, but I missed it. The 5-year window of moving from 8.5 to 8%. What is the effect on the contribution rate and the funding ratio for you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, for us, the funding ratio would drop probably 1.5% or 2%. So we go from 87 to probably 85.5. From a contribution rate standpoint, it would increase our contributions by 0.5 or 0.6%. Now, in the same bill, there are some assumption changes that lower that a little bit. For example, salary growth. The bill proposes lowering salary growth. State employees have not gotten huge raises, so our actuaries recommended some slower salary growth. That will save us 0.2 or 0.3% because benefits aren't going to grow. So the net of this bill will increase our contribution, our required contribution rate by 0.3. It doesn't actually do anything at this point. It doesn't increase contributions, but it would increase our required contributions by about 0.3%.
Representative Winkler? Mr. Chair, I don't have any further questions for Mr. Bergstrom. I would be interested in getting the same information as I suspect we will from TRA and PARA, but I'm also interested in hearing from Mr. Bicker about this assumption change.
Okay. Maybe we can go to Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really, the questions I'm about to ask can be answered by any of the three that are present, and I would welcome a little bit of a conversation and discussion. The rate that we choose, 8, 8.5, whatever that number is, those are targets that we're looking at. And the question that comes up is, if you raise the target, well, we could be funded faster. If we lower the target, we can be funded at a less aggressive rate. The question is, what's the right reasonable target? And I question if 8% is even the right target in a market that we're in right now. And the first of the couple of questions that I'd like to propose is, what happens if we have 8% and we don't get the funding levels that we're looking at and we start paying out benefits? How does PERA, MSRP, and TRA pay benefits if the fund is insufficiently funded?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, I'll take the shot from my perspective. First of all, we have $9 billion in assets. We're not a pay-as-you-go system, so we have 87% of what we need to pay for our projected lifetime benefits. Back in 2009, when the market fell, we had an 8.5% investment return. And our boards were concerned sufficiently enough to come back to you and propose legislative changes. We lowered our cost of living adjustments. We, in some cases, we had some contribution rate changes. We made some other changes to lower our costs as well. So regardless of what investment assumption we use, we would be back looking for some solution. And it all was not asking for more money in 2010. A lot of it had to do with sacrifice on behalf of our employees and our retirees in the package that we put together. For MSRS, that cut our liabilities by about, just MSRS, by about $750 million. So regardless of what the assumption changes are, you know, we're certainly going to monitor this, and if our funding continues to drop, we will come back with some other changes.
Mr. Chair, as I said, I'd like to hear from all three just from their perspective on that.
Ms. Hackey, maybe you could address
sure.
This
next just to address your Mr. Chair, Laurie Hacking with Teachers Retirement Association. To address Representative Driscoll's question, I would agree with my colleague's comments that the past 10 years our return has really only been about 5.9%. So it almost doesn't matter what we would have assumed. We were going to have financial difficulties because of the severe market downturn. So what really matters is the action that we do take when there is a drop to put together changes that will get us back on track. So that's, you know, I would just echo Mr. Bergstrom's comments in that regard.
Okay, and would you like to address the question also, please?
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director, Representative O'Driscoll, I don't have anything to add to what my colleagues have said. We looked at the seriousness of the drop in 2009. We dealt with it. The legislature supported it, and we have made a commitment to the commission that if the numbers are wrong, we will continue to work with our membership, our employers, and the legislature in addressing anything that would come forward.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up question on that. If we do find where it's predicted that a large number of the state's workforce is fast approaching retirement age as a part of the baby boomers, we would be paying benefits out to individuals. Is it possible that the benefits that individuals would receive because of a shortfall be modified in COLA increases and different things that could potentially cause some problems for retirees as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, in 2010 we did lower our cost of living adjustment. MSRS lowered their adjustment from 2.5 to 2 until we get to 90% funded. TRA had 2-year freeze of cost of living adjustments, and then to 2. PERA actually lowered theirs to 1. We were challenged by a handful of our retirees, and we were successful in court. And I really think it shows that we were proactive. It shows the legislature was proactive, and it was a bipartisan bill. And, you know, it's something really Minnesota should be proud of. New York recently made the newspaper. They're lowering benefits for future hires to a level still higher than ours. When you read about what's happening in other states, they're touting an age 63, I think, full retirement age. We were 66 back in 1989. Our costs are among the lowest in the country as well. So, we take our job seriously. I should be a member of the Hair Club for Men, and I'm also a member of this club as well. So, I do hope that, I have to take care of selfishly myself and others behind me. But, we've been through some tough times. There's absolutely no question. But if you reflect back and knowing where we came from, in our case, our funding, in all of our cases, our funding has improved by almost 20%. And that's pretty remarkable. And it's a testament to the legislature's fortitude. And it was supported by our group, our retirees, our active members.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, if I might just follow up with one final question. I've talked about kind of the doomsday, what happens if we don't, what happens if we, the Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, just right. What happens if we're on the other end of that and for some reason we lower the expectation to 8% for returns and we end up at 10, 11.5%? I know that we get funded faster. What would that do to the long-term stability and viability of the fund?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, I'll answer that. That would be awesome. if that happened. I think one of the lessons that all of us should have learned through this is that when you have a sufficiency, you don't spend it or you don't cut contributions. And that has been done in both cases. MSRS was 109% funded at one point. And then the urge is, everything is rosy. So let's increase benefits or let's cut contribution rates. And they've done that. TRA has had a fairly substantial contribution rate cut back when they were back in the 90s, when they got to a nice funding rate. So I think there are some lessons learned that there's nothing wrong with being 110% funded, 115% funded. We should keep our hands off with it. Rather than cutting contributions, let's build in some cushion if that happens.
Okay. Maybe we could go back and if Ms. Hacking and Ms. Vennick could answer Representative Winkler's questions, I could have him restate that if you need to.
What they are. I'll try. I'll give it a shot. Laurie Hacking with Teachers Retirement. I believe you asked what has been our funding ratio trend and what's the impact of the bill and when do we expect to be fully funded? What's our future trend expected? As Mr. Brixner already alluded to, we were actually well over 100% funded at the end of the 1990s, and even through most of the 2000s. In 2007, we were 92% funded, but in just 2 years, by 2009, we had dropped to just below 60%. So it was a very big hit that we took because of the markets. Since then, we have rebounded, and at the end of fiscal 2011, we are between 77-78% funded. So again, the 2010 reform bill made a huge difference. It reduced our liabilities by $1.75 billion, and we also do have some contribution increases that have occurred and are scheduled to occur in the future that will help get us back on a better footing. In terms of the future projection, our actuaries now do that. In fact, it's going to be part of the reports that the commission receives from us. So our projections, of course, depending upon future market returns, are to gradually improve from our current level of 77-78%, gradually improve over the next 20-30 years toward 90-95%. But again, that depends on the markets. And then the question was, what is the impact of this particular bill? It would shave, for TRA, it would take about 1-2% off of our funded ratio. So instead of 77-78% funded, we would be closer to 76% funded. And it would increase our required contribution rates or our increase our costs, I should say, by 0.76% of payroll. Okay. If that gives you hopefully that answers your questions.
Thank you. Ms. Fanning?
Mr. Chair and members, PERA was about 74% funded in 2007. Now, we weren't as well funded as the other plans, but we had made significant advances in having our contributions coming in so that they were sufficient. We didn't have a deficiency, so we were collecting money that would have kept us on track to get to 100% funded by 2031, our target date. The 2009 results of the recession moved us down to just under 54% funded. It was pretty devastating, so the 2010 reforms were very, very necessary for this plan. Today, we are back at, as of July 1st, 2011, back to 75% funded. Our contributions are still sufficient so that we are moving on track to get to full funding by 2031. And the results of moving to 8% permanently would have taken us down to 72% funded and would have required a contribution increase of just under 1% of pay. By applying the 5-year at 8% and 8.5% thereafter, we would move down to about 74% funded, a little under that, and would require a contribution increase of about 0.4% of pay. Under our law, we are not required to recommend a contribution rate increase unless we are 0.5% short for 2 consecutive years. So the bill as is would not trigger a required contribution rate increase for PERA. Now, that's just estimates. There are so many other moving pieces in the bill with the salary growth assumptions and the payroll growth assumptions that these are rough estimates, and we'll have to wait till it's all settled out to give you an exact number. But as we understand it today, we're still good to go and on track to get back to full funding by 2031, which is the date you require us to be.
Okay, thank you. Representative Winkler, did that address your questions?
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in other words, the things are doing well. I mean, it's one question I had, Mr. Bergstrom answered about what happened in the past with funding, and I happen to have served on the Pension Commission up until this year, so I understand some of the stuff that we've gone through. But in the past, when they were 100% funded, we lowered contribution rates and in some cases increased benefit payouts because of market rates that were coming into the plans, and so we put more liabilities on the fund. But I guess the other question I have here, and I just make sure that I understand this correctly and the rest of the committee does, is when you say you're 87% funded in the MSRS, that means that if we stopped making contributions today and didn't put any more in the plan, you'd have 87% of the money you needed to pay out all your liabilities in going into the future. Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, I don't think it's quite that attractive because we you know, we assume future money coming in, we assume benefits, we assume investment return, so it's not quite that attractive. But essentially, if we meet all of our targets, we would be able to pay 87% of the benefits for retirees and active members for their lifetime, and it's a good place to be. It's a lot different than Social Security, where it's a pay-as-you-go system. Mm-hmm. You know, we, you know, so it's, I wish it were that rosy, but it's, okay. You know, so.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering whether Ms. Vanek and Ms. Hacking could answer the question that Mr. Bergstrom did about how you compare, if there is a comparable fund, how you compare to other states or in the national average.
Ms. Hacking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, we are about average being at 78% funded. That is roughly what the average you will see in most other states at this point for funding ratios. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, at 75%, we're just a little below the average, but we're very close.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is specific for PERA and Director Vanek. You have within PERA a subgroup with the police and fire, and the numbers that you were talking about, are those segregated differently, or is there an aggregate that you reported for all funds or sub-funds?
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I've only been speaking to our largest plan, the General Employees Plan. Our police and fire fund was down as low as 63% funded on a market value at the end of the recession or the 2009 period. The police and fire plan has rebounded to about 83% funded, but while that's a good place to be, because anything above 80%, you know that you're pretty comfortable if you're tracking in the right direction. That plan has a pretty substantial contribution deficiency, and it's right now measuring at about 4.8%. And with the assumption rate change, we haven't had the actuary value that, but we do expect that we'll add another 1% to 2% to that deficiency. But you should all know that the police and fire membership is very aware of this. We started meeting before the session started and agreed that we would come back together when the session ended and make some pretty tough decisions about what changes need to be made in that plan and if there are any other revenue sources other than just going to straight contribution rate increases. We're going to look at the whole thing and prepare a recommendation to the legislature because that plan needs to be addressed.
Any other member questions? Representative Scalzi.
Just related to that last point about the police and fire has rebounded, did you say 83%? And I'm wondering then why is it crucial that there have to be some changes made?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, when your contributions are less than what you need to be collecting going forward, as you assume that your interest assumption, you're going to earn the interest on the money that you need to have coming into the plan. And our data shows us that we need more money coming into the plan to fund the benefits, and that's why we need to look at solutions to how that gets made, that difference gets made up.
Okay, any additional member questions? Okay, thank you to the testifiers, and I think we will ask Julie Blail to come up from Ask Me. Okay, let's hold on that a second. There's been a request for Mr. Vickers to come up and talk to us about investments. Good morning, Mr. Vickers. Welcome to the committee. Representative Winkler, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bicker, I know that you're going to tell us that these assumptions are going to be wrong, but I wonder if you could review for us and remind us again about historical returns and give us some perspective on 8.5% versus 8%.
Mr. Vickers.
Mr. Chairman and members, from a historical perspective, you can pick your time period. Over since 1-1 of 1980, which is as far back as we have clean data, which is 32 years, we have had annualized returns of slightly under 10%. As has been testified, over the last 10 years, we were over 5. But I guess the old sign you see in all the TV ads is past performance doesn't guarantee future anything. We were, from a staff perspective, we were requested by the retirement systems to do a review of assumed rates. And the Investment Advisory Council, which advises both the staff and the board, went through all of this. We did a review of assumed rates, and we get input from all over the Wall Street and consultants and whatnot. When we did this in 2008, using our asset allocation, the assumed rate of return was 9.36%. We did the same study, basically using a lot of the same resources, a few months ago, and the projection going forward was down to 8.36%. It was down 1% in 3 years. And that's a big number, especially when you're looking at a pretty diversified portfolio. Now, That is an assumed rate of 8.36% given our asset allocation for approximately the next 10 years. That was the input from the street. Now, that's also before any management fees and expenses and whatever, which for us is probably a tenth of a percent. Therefore, when my advisory council was asked related to 8.5 versus 8 versus another number, the advisory council didn't recommend a number, but they just recommended it should probably go down. That recommendation and that work is consistent with the reduction from 8.5 to 8 over a period of time, whether it's 5 years or whatever, and then to have it reevaluated at that point in time. So, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler is absolutely correct. We don't have a clue. I mean, the reality is the market's going to do what the market's going to do. I mean, if we would have done this 2 years ago, everybody says you couldn't make anything. You know, in March of 2009, we kept all the windows locked because nobody, we were going to jump out. I mean, it was not a good environment. You know, the last 2 years, we've made 15, 8, and 23, 3. But the years before that, we lost a lot of money. All we can do is look at these things on average over a long period of time. Also, there are a number of entities, just like State Investment Board and legislature around the country, and basically the trend is down. And there are, I believe, 9 funds at 8.5% around the country. We're half of those, and the number seems to be more around 8%. CalPERS is at 7.5, and CalPERS has its special circumstances to do a lot of different things. So, Mr. Chairman and members, again, I hate to say, we really don't know. But what we do know is the input from Wall Street is tending downward as far as expected returns over the next 10 years. If we were asked to redo that in 2015, I can guarantee you the number will be different. I just can't tell you which way it will be different. That's probably as much and as evasive an answer as I can give you.
Representative Winkler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Bicker. It was predictably and suitably evasive. I guess it's interesting to me that there, between 2008 and 2012, there's a full point drop in the expected rate over the next 10 years, which I think goes to show that there's an innate human tendency to assume that whatever you're living with right now is what's going to happen into the future.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that is absolutely true.
And it also suggests that the recommendation is just another kind of dart that you're throwing at the wall to some degree. And I guess I just, you know, this isn't for you, Mr. Bicker, to the bill, I'm not sure that I see a huge advantage to Minnesota in changing the statutory rate of assumption. There isn't anything that we can predict about the next 30 years to say that it will be different, the same, better, or worse than the last 30 years. I mean, we just have no idea. Present economics, present politics are not very good indicators of the reality over the next 30 years. And it seems more of a political question than anything else.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Winkler, that is probably one answer. All I can say is there are a lot of people who have looked at this issue both in the public arena and the private arena, and expected returns for most asset classes are lower now than they were 10 years ago.
Mr. Brickers, I might say that a 5.9% rate of return over the past 10 years is very enviable. There are a lot of money managers out there that would probably have loved to have that number. However, a 40% drop, and I will preface that with the whole market was dropping 40% back in 2008 and 2009. Are we taking too much risk with the funds?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, my answer to that would be no, but. Mr. Bergstrom and the other directors have talked about, when we have this money for these defined benefit plans, we have a 30 or 40 year time horizon. And if you have a 30 or 40 year time horizon, I think it's very prudent to have a relatively risky portfolio. The lesson we have to learn from this is those returns are going to be very volatile. There are going to be very good years and there's going to be not so good years. And we have to learn the lesson that when we have a good year, we don't spend it. Because we're looking at, pick your number, 8.5, 8, whatever it is, on average over very long periods of time. During the 90s, I mean, everybody made a ton of money. I mean, if you couldn't make 20% a year, you're nuts. Okay, and that was kind of the assumption. And we gave huge benefit increases to retirees. That was the statutory requirement. And we spent the problems of 2000s in 1990. If we hadn't done anything in the 90s and we became 120% funded, when we had the terrorist issue and the World Trade Center problems in 2001, and we had the real estate issues and others in 2008 and 2009, we would have been okay. We wouldn't have been great, but we would have been okay. But I think that's the lesson that we all have to learn. If we're going to play in the pension world in a defined benefit manner and invest these assets and administer these assets and make recommendations related to these assets, we got to do them in 30-year blocks, not 3-year blocks. And you know, if everything had been left alone, and I'm as guilty as anybody, but if everything had been left alone, we would have been okay. But I have a father-in-law who's a retired teacher. He's 90 years old, and he's making a heck of a lot more money now than when he was teaching. And, you know, back 10 years ago, it wasn't "Hi, Howie," it was "What's the benefit increase? Hi, Howie." And so that's what I had to live with, and that was the realities. But, you know, I think we need to have a relatively aggressive long-term investment approach to, you know, if you're running a defined benefit plan.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Other questions from the members for Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bickers, you are exactly right. It is difficult to be able to pin down what the rates of return are going to be, because if we could look over our shoulder to predict the future, it would make it a lot easier. And with your experience in this, you may have a future in meteorology, too. I'm not exactly sure. But that being said, and I want to follow up on the question that Representative Winkler had proposed to you, and that is 8 versus 8.5% over a longer period of time. You're right, there is no way to know whether it's 8, 8.5, 7.75, 11, whatever percent it might be. But isn't it easier to be able to build in predictability if we have a lower bogey that we're shooting for, to be able to make things stable for people who are receiving benefits, who are anticipating benefits, and those who have to make contributions for future benefits through payroll deduction?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I guess the answer is yes. I mean, that's more of a question really for the retirement administrators. My job is more the investment side and not projecting benefits. The reality is I would be crazy to argue with you if the assumed rate was zero. My job's a lot easier. So, you know, my job and the job of the State Investment Board is to construct an investment program that will try to make the return that you all set for a bogey. The reality is, given the assumptions that we have now received and have just done with the study in 2011, really, that Ray now has a projected return of, you know, around 8.25%, if the interest rate is to stay at 8.5 or if it goes to 8, I will not make any changes in my investment program because I need the same investment program right now, and I'm pretty much as far as I can go in my risk exposure in the portfolio. So from an investment perspective, we will not make any significant changes depending on what the legislature does with the assumed rate of return.
Representative O'Driscoll. So would it be safe to say that by moving it from 8.5% to 8%, we've made your job, I won't say easier, but we've provided you some margin of error in the return?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the reality is if you look at our historical returns, especially on an annualized basis, we're almost never close to 8. We're either down or up 15 or up 20. I mean, that's just the way the world's been. But, you know, if my long-term bogey is 8 versus the long-term bogey of 8.5 or 9 or 7.5, the lower number is easier for us. I mean, simple as that. But from a pension policy standpoint, I mean, that's really more for the retirement administrators and the legislature and the pension commission.
Mr. Vickers, that brings up a question I was thinking of. With that number bouncing all over the place, do you correlate closely to the S&P? Is that something that we could watch and say that, or are you at 98% of it or 102% of it? Or?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have a portion of our portfolio in U.S. common stocks, and a good chunk of that's indexed. We index it to a broader bogey than the S&P 500. We use something called the Russell 3000, which is 3,000 stocks instead of 500 stocks, as the S&P is. So a portion of our portfolio will very much match whatever the U.S. equity portfolio does, but we have international equities, we have bonds, we have private equity, we have some real estate, and we've got some cash. So. Okay,
thank you. Any additional questions for the testifiers? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Right, I believe we have Julie Vile from Ask Me. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5, and I'm here today representing a number of organizations of active public employees and retired public employees, and I'll state their names in my testimony. We have spent the last few months working with the Pension Commission, sitting in on their hearings, and listening to the discussions that have taken place here today and in the meetings. We have arrived at a conclusion that the 2010 reforms need more opportunity to work. We stepped up to the plate and supported the 2010 reforms. They have provided an increase in the funds to the tune of about $6 billion since they were enacted. We want to provide more time for those reforms to work and allow an opportunity in the future to take a look at the status of where the funds are. And we also do not believe that there is a crisis. During the hearing today, you've referenced a number of other states. Minnesota is not in the same situation as those states. There's been a tremendous responsibility that's just been assumed by the participants in these plans. They are our members and the retirees. When it's come to employee and employer contribution increases, we have supported them. When it's come to capping COLAs, we have reluctantly supported them. We have done the very best that we possibly can to assure the stability of the funds, and there is not a crisis. The organizations that I'm about to read are opposed to pension legislation moving forward this session, and they include AFSCME Council 5, 43,000 members, Education Minnesota, 70,000 members, the Minnesota Government Engineers Council, Middle Management Association, 2,800 members, the Minneapolis Committee of 13, 10,000 members, the Interfaculty Organization, 4,000 members, the Minnesota Nurses Association, 2,000 members. Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, 13,000 members. The Minnesota State College Faculty, 4,500 members. Education Minnesota Retired, 6,000 members. AFSCME Council 5 Retirees United. The Minnesota State Troopers Association, 850 active members. The Police Federation of Minneapolis, 850 members. Retired Educators Association of Minnesota. The Minnesota AFL-CIO. SEIU Local 284, 8,000 members. Teamsters Local 320, 11,000 members. The Minnesota Professional Firefighters, 1,600 members. And AFSCME Council 65, 13,000 members. And Mr. Chairman, we respectfully ask that this legislation not move forward this session. Thank you.
Well, Ms. Blyle, I would disagree with you that there's a crisis going on here. You're hearing that. I think the members are simply asking questions because we have a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that this plan is well-funded and that we understand how it operates. And I took most of the questions from members today as educating themselves and learning more about the plan and making sure that we're doing our job to operate the plan. So I did not sense anything crisis in nature here. I sensed members wanting to know what the question, you know, asking questions so that they just better understand things.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to comment. I wasn't making that allegation toward individual questions that came forward today in the committee. That's in reference to other organizations, and I'm not here today to start naming names, but that have indicated there's a crisis, and all you need to do is go back and look at some of the editorials that have been run in some of the publications throughout the state.
Thank you. Questions for the testifier? Thank you. Any? Mr. Bergstrom, would you like to?
Mr. Chair, I'll keep it short.
Okay.
As part of our testimony, first of all, I do thank the unions for their support over the changes in 2010, but I also want to make it clear that pension plans and our boards support Representative Lanning's proposal to lower the investment assumption for that five-year period. We do think it's prudent. We do think the study then in 4 years will help as well. So I just wanted to, as part of the testimony, I failed to mention that we are supportive of what Representative Lanning put together. He did a nice job of compromising and trying to meet a lot of people's needs.
We appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Are there any additional testifiers in the audience that would like to speak for, against, or about this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lanning, would you like to come back up with any closing comments that you might have? And while you're approaching, I'd just like to thank you and the members of the Pension Commission for all the work that you have done. I know that you have worked diligently, tirelessly to put this together and been meeting very regular on this issue. We thank you for your work on it and appreciate all that you're doing.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And I want to pay thanks to all the commission members and especially mention the members of the House who represent you, represent us on the commission, Representative Kahn, Representative Murphy, Representative Smith, and Representative Kiffmeyer, and I are the five House members. Members, what you have before you is, I think, a fair and reasonable compromise. And I understand that there are people who don't want to make any more changes, that would just like to let things be. 2010, as I stated earlier, enacted some very good and positive reforms. This bill doesn't do anything to change what we did in 2010. It addresses a question that was not addressed in 2010, and that is the issue of the assumed rate of return and where that ought to be. And it seems to me that even Mr. Baker pointed out that their best investment advice is saying that we're down to, they're saying 8.3 or thereabouts percent is what they're assuming for the next 10 years. That's less than 8.5 just from our best investment advisors. And members, I would say, how close do we want to call this? I mean, as everybody has pointed out, it's kind of a guessing game. But wouldn't it be prudent to not call it so close? And the trend line nationally and states all around the country is to examine this issue and kind of lower those kinds of expected rates of return. And so, members, this is a good bill. It's a compromise bill that has bipartisan support, and we ask for your support.
Representative Winkler. Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, I actually have a question about your Article 2, the contribution adequacy reporting. And the only question the general comment I would make is, you know, when you're investing over 30 years, you don't want to check your 401k every day. That's a really bad habit to get into. And one of the mistakes that we have made is by essentially overcommitting ourselves in good times. And the kind of short-term decision-making or short-term reaction on pension questions can be a bad thing. And so I'm wondering with this additional reporting, whether we might subject the legislature to irrational exuberance and irrational depression about what's going on with our pensions by doing this every 2 years and providing this kind of information in this format. That's my concern. And it seems to me that if the pension commissions and the funds are following this, that might be the best place to leave it. But is this information that the commission's not getting?
Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, basically what this provision calls for is the information is already there. It requires that this information be put in a form that's more readily available and transparent to legislators and anybody who might want to follow it. The funds will probably have some additional work in the process of doing this, along with MMB, but it's information that they have to collect, are collecting already. It's putting it into a form that makes the whole pension system more transparent in terms of what is the real status. And I mean, I think all of us are very concerned about transparency in whatever aspect of government we're talking about. And that's what this provision is all about.
Representative Winkler. And finally, I hope we maintain the same discipline that we've historically had and take the time, as I know you have, Mr. Chair, to actually understand our pensions and where we are and not assume that experience in other places is guiding us in Minnesota right now. I think we've come a long way in the last year on pensions in the legislature just in our level of understanding. I don't support the change to 8% right now. We've come through we're in the middle of, I still think, very tumultuous economic times, and we've come through a lot of stormy weather. And I think the reason to give things more time and to not make a change and to let things, events settle out a bit more is just this very difference between a 9.36. All the smart people said 9.36. in 2008, and now all the smart people say 8.36 in 2012, and that's a very radical change. And I think it's a sign of just how volatile economics of the last several years have been. And I think it would be more cautious for us not to change that assumed rate of return and give the markets and give the economy time to get on a little bit more of a ordinary footing or a customary footing after going through a very deep recession and a financial crisis. So I just think we're still not out of the period of time where we're where we're reacting strongly to serious events, and we should just let Minnesota and its pension system wait for calmer times and reassess this in another year or two.
Representative Lanning, did you want to address this?
Mr. Chairman, I say that the 2010 reforms are going to continue to play out. I believe that they will continue to pay dividends for us. But this issue of the rate of return was not a part of that package. I think it's prudent for us to be making this adjustment at this point in time and to be a bit on the cautious side with regard to this. And members, if you leave it where it is, I think we run the risk of continuing to make some promises that we may not be able to keep. And I care very deeply about the state of Minnesota keeping its promises with our employees. And if we set, if we continue to assume more than what we are realistically can expect, I believe that we're in effect continuing to make potentially some promises that down the road we're not going to be able to keep. And we're going to make it, you know, if the market doesn't rebound, if in fact things continue to struggle as they have been and go nowhere near 8.5% the next 5 years, we're going to compound the problem of fixing this 5 years from now. We're going to make it even more difficult and more painful for everyone. And again, I say that this, Representative Winkler, this bill doesn't need to go to state government finance because we're not, with this bill, causing governments to increase their contributions, or employees for that matter. Down the road, if things don't improve, that issue may very well have to be addressed by the legislature, but it's not addressed in this bill. We're just simply saying, look at this goal, this target needs to be adjusted. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Nelson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while I have concerns about the rate of the assumption rate being dropped, I support this bill and I support the work of the Representative Lanning did on the Pension Commission. Like any compromise legislation, there might be things that we do and do not like. And I understand that the Pension Commission and Representative Matt Lanning looked at this long and hard and came up with a reasonable solution to look at this over the next 5 years. And I support this legislation going forward. I think we should pass this and so that we have a stability in our pension system.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no further questions from the members, Chair Pepin would renew her motion that House File 2199 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion carries. Any additional? Okay, Representative Pepin.
Members, I just wanted to let you know this is probably our last official meeting. There may be one more bill. I'm not sure where that stands. You might know what I'm talking about. Also, I'm planning on having one or two informational hearings, which will likely be after the final deadlines. That they'll just be informational in nature. So, just to keep checking your email. Thank you.
Madam Chair, is that so we're not going to have a stadium bill in this committee, is that?
No. Representative Hornstein, that's an unknown answer.
Okay.
Yeah. Last year at this time, you were saying the same thing.
Yes, we've been saying the same thing for a while. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, members. With that, we are adjourned.